Hey, this is Woody from Bastille, and you're listening to the Stage Left Podcast.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all the episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Supergrass, Jungle, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, The 1975, Madness, Oasis, The Zootons, The Prodigy and Kraftwerk, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who worked in the studio and on stage with the Beatles, Beyonce, Elvis and David Bowie, plus special episodes with comedian Stuart Lee, producer Tony Visconti and singer-songwriter Ezra Furman. Today we have a very special episode as we are joined by the multi-award winning Kate Nash, who, as well as being lauded by critics as an accomplished songwriter and performer, has also been celebrated for a role in Netflix series Glow and in the new thought-provoking comedy drama Coffee Wars, which is available now. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Kate Nash. Thanks for joining today, Kate. How's it going?
Good. Yeah, thanks for having us. Great intro. Loved that.
Thank you so much. So I want to kick off. Thank you. I just wanted to kick off with, obviously, the new film Coffee Wars covers a lot of thought-provoking topics, including female entrepreneurship. And Kate, from your perspective, I want to pick up from our last episode, which was with someone called Bim, who is a singer with Bastille. And she, to quote her, basically said that the music industry is not built for women. And that there are all these hurdles that she has to overcome, including things like the design of tour buses and the height of toilets and the facilities within tour buses. And we explored the idea of inclusive design, which was probably a case that the reason that that isn't how it should be is because, there probably weren't women sat around the table when it came to designing tour buses, unfortunately. You've obviously been in the industry for kind of 15, 20 years now. What are the barriers that you think have been removed in that time, and what are the barriers that what else needs to change?
That's so interesting. And I think, God, I never thought about that. I recently I'm like working with a personal trainer at the moment because I had this injury and I'm trying to like build strength back from it. And we were talking about how that like so much of like everything about exercise has been built around the male body and like all the info, everything basically in the world, I guess, has been built around a man's body. But it was really interesting in the physical context. And I never thought about that on a tour bus or anything, but God, yeah, that's so true.
What has changed? And
what has changed? I think what has changed? I do think that like the way that I was spoken to and about when I was 18, it would not be considered acceptable anymore. I do sort of think back on the way they're like press like spoke about me and how I looked and stuff like that. I just think that like younger girls like can reclaim their image more in a way where they like garner like support online. It's this weird battle because it's like I literally was called like too ugly and too fat to be a pop star and like constantly slated for how I looked and like it was very personal, you know what I mean? I don't think that that has gone away, but in like it still exists, but in a different way, if that makes sense. Like I think because of social media, which I think has so many like negative things about it, but like the positives are that like we were able to like reclaim a little bit of, like I remember when there was an article written about Kate Winslet and it was about, this was probably in like 2009 or 10, and it was about how many divorces she had. And it was just like slagging off her getting divorced loads of times. And I remember loads of women on Twitter were like, this isn't an article. You can't just write this about a woman. Like, why has this been printed in a newspaper? This is ridiculous. And it was the first time I felt like women in the public eye could like stand up for each other and say like, we don't accept that. Like, you're not writing these articles about men. Like Kate Winslet is an amazing actor and like has done so much in her career. And like, we're writing an article about how many divorces she's had. This is crazy. And I do think that people being able to speak back to the media has changed it a little bit. But you know, you see it exist in other ways, I suppose, like in the Daily Mail comments and think like it's still there, hatred of women, but it's sort of shifted, I think, a little bit. What has changed in the music industry? I do see a lot more women in music being celebrated than when I was first starting. I feel like there was like five of us and they would always be like, wow, there's like five of you. That's so many women. Whereas now I do think that like there are more women and girls in bands, but you still see the same headliners at festivals. Like you're still not seeing like loads of female headliners. So that means like women are not like making as much money, you know, on festival season and things like that. I think that like there's still a belief that from bookers, I actually spoke to like a festival booker once who was like basically saying that, and I know this has been in the media as well, that it's like not what audiences want, which I think is not true. And, you know, audiences are being given curated things all the time. So you just have to like make those changes and they'll, you know, like, I just don't believe that they don't want that. I just think it's sort of like no one wants to take a risk, which apparently like a female headliner is a risk.
What are the ways in which things can be changed? So if you probably know like Benedict Cumberbatch, as a demonstration of allyship a few years ago, changed his contract so that he will only appear in a film where the lead female is paid the same.
Oh, that's
and I
great.
I know other artists have done that. So like 1975 signed it recently, so they'll only get paid a headlining fee the same as kind of the top billing female.
Good.
Can you think of other things that need to change?
I think it's like what is being said behind closed doors, because I feel like you hear, I've spoken to lots of women that work in the industry that will say what you hear in meetings by like heads of departments and men in power is often like, it's sort of unbelievable. You're like, it doesn't sound very 2023 what people are saying, you know. And I think that there's a lot being done on like a surface level, like showing like, these are our ethics, this is what we believe in. And I've been in this situation before where I'm like somewhere where someone's like, this is what our establishment stands for, but the behavior in the establishment doesn't meet what they're saying that they stand for. But it's almost like, oh well, we tick these boxes, we say we do this, this and this, we don't actually have to act on it. And I personally am someone who will always speak out when there's something I see wrong and that's something I don't think is moral and something I think is unethical. And I think, I guess if you're in a position of power, you really have to use your voice, because saying that like the door is open for anyone to come and like tell us how they feel, that's actually not how it should be. The door is open. So the person in power should be stepping out of the door and like being involved in like how everything's happening, because people don't have the confidence or the power to go in and like make complaints, because it's like a risk to their career if they make complaints. And that is just true. So I think that like people in positions of power need to stop sort of having that ethos that like our door is always open, so you can come to us about anything, and actually like you should be the ones going out there and seeing what's wrong and changing it, instead of like telling people they can come to you, because like they don't feel like they can. In most places, because it's like people don't want to rock the boat and they don't want to like risk losing opportunities and money and jobs and reputation. It's so annoying that it's tough, because really the job itself is so fun and joyful, and we're so privileged to be able to be musicians, and like that, to have that as a career is something I'm always so grateful for. But why I do speak up about it not being like, I just don't think it's right, it's not okay, it's unethical, a lot of the practices, the way it's structured, it's such an unprofessional, in it's so old-fashioned, it's so unprofessional. I mean, so many clowns, like I am like 35, been doing this, you know, for a long time now. And I meet people that are older than me and I just think, I don't know how you got this job. I don't know how you're doing this. You're not like, you're just so unprofessional. And it's like, having had experience outside of the music industry, in other industries, you're like, oh, there's professionalism. Wow. Especially for me, because it was my, I only knew the music industry. And then when I got into acting, I was like, oh my God, wow, there's all these like things in place to protect me. And there's all these like legal hours. I can only work for these many hours. Like my safety is thought about. I could go to all of these different people. I have a union. I have like, you know, what my minimum wage, like there's like a legal minimum wage. Like the music industry doesn't have that. There was protests at South by Southwest this year to get like it agreed that there should be at least $750 paid to artists per show, which by the way, it costs so much more than $750 to like get to South by. And you know, if you're just like literally going on your like, even if you were literally traveling on your own to South by Southwest and playing acoustic guitar, it's going to cost you like thousands of dollars to do that. So why are we begging to be paid for our work? Our work is so devalued. And the reason it's really important to complain about it is not like our industry is not just for rich people. The arts is not just for the rich. Like we should be fighting for things to be fairer so that working class people can enter this industry and make a living if they have nothing to fall back on. No parents with money to fall back on, like all of these safety nets that people have in place. Like if you don't have them, it's such a risk to be in music because there's so little protecting you. And so often people are literally stealing from you, ripping you off. Like I've experienced that. It's a very common story. And like for some people, I was able to come back from being stolen from, not because my parents have money, because they don't, but because I had a number one record and I had a big enough fan base to sort of like, and I got Glow, I got a job for Netflix. So those two things like helped me come back. Well, what about the people that got stolen from that don't have Netflix, that don't have Made of Bricks? That was actually it for them. You know what I mean? And that's like that publishing deal was it. And they're not going to get another one and they have to go home and they can't afford to like keep living in expensive cities or trying to make it work as a musician. And I think it's really important to complain about what is wrong so that we can try and like put more protection in so that music can be for everyone, because we need diversity in the music, like in the music world. I resent even saying the music business, but we do as well, because I just like hate the music business so much. But we need good people in the music business too to change the lay of the land.
Hi there, this is John Woff, the saxophonist with the 1975, and my favourite episode of the Stage Left podcast has to be episode 49 of Bob Reynolds. His anecdotes of working as a sideman alongside John Mayer are absolutely fascinating. Go and take a listen.
So we have a lot of young musicians listening to this who are in the point of their career where they're about to step into the industry, and yeah, they might be brilliant artists and they step into the music business and they're like, shit, I don't know where to begin. And their fear often is these kind of the sharks. And you know, Kate, you brought it up and I don't know how much you can talk about it, but we can refer to it. You know, you were stolen from by a trusted person who was a professional in the music industry.
Yeah.
You know, and it led you, I believe, if this is right, you had to sell clothes and work in a, you know, comic book store. I don't know how true that is, but you were in a bit of a bad place.
That is true. That's what happened to me.
And what might you have done differently?
I think it's really difficult to look back and say, what would I do differently, because of the way that my entire career sort of like exploded and all the people that were sort of in my life. I think it also speaks volumes that none of the people that were around during Made of Bricks, My Best Friend Is You, are in my life now. None of them. No one. I find that to be so like noisy. Do you know what I mean? In my brain, I'm like, wow, none of those people are around. This is my advice to young people. I think that like it is really difficult to get educated about the business side of the industry, because if you're an artist, like that's not your strong point. That is not like, that's not our skill set. I'm not someone who's like, oh, I'm a girl boss. Like I'm not actually, I'm an artist. I really hate doing business. I'm terrible at writing emails. I'm like, how do I speak professionally? Like that's just not my forte whatsoever. Like I do shows, I tour, I write songs. Like I have loads of skill sets, but like business is not one of them. But I do think there is an in-between where to get a grip on your business to basically like be more in control of your business, to make sure that you know, especially if you're young, that you are the boss, you're employing everyone else. If you're the artist, you're employing everyone else. Lots of people will come and try and make decisions about your finances for you, and the buck stops with you. And you need to have the confidence to like trust your instincts if something feels wrong. It depends like really where you're at, you know, in your career. But I think like management is really difficult to find management, but it is important to find someone that you trust if you are working with a manager. Trying to stay on top of your own finances would probably be something that would help you the most. And finding like a couple of people that you can trust, whether it's a tour manager, like my tour manager has been in my life for years and he will always like help me do things that like, that's such a big part of my business, my life, industry. So like my band and my tour manager are like the people I trust the most, I would say, in my career.
But on that, lots of people who would have been ripped off probably trusted those people, right? So what does that trust actually look like, right? So
but sometimes you're trusting people that, you know, if I look back on everyone, like relationships, like love life, work life, did I really like, I don't know that I would say I completely trusted those people. But sometimes you're in a position where you're sort of like, I don't have anyone else, and I sort of am going with this person, and I'm like thinking that I guess it's like, it's like thinking there's a certain level that of respect that generally human beings will have for each other that you realize as you become an adult that many people do not, and people will overstep that mark and like take from you as much as possible, especially if you're an artist, because it's this exciting job and people want to be around it and they know there's money to be made and there's fame and, you know, there's things that people want to like grab onto. Yeah, this is why I think it's really hard to quantify into advice. Do you know what I mean? I think like we need like what, like it's not really just the responsibility of the artist is the thing, because you're going to be too busy. You're going to trust the wrong people. You're going to like that's not your that's not your level of expertise. I do think you'd have to like quit being an artist if you wanted to like get really good at business. You wouldn't have time. But we need on a fundamental, like the inner workings of the industry to change so that it's not just on the artist to go, oh, well, what did you do wrong? Like you trusted all the wrong people. Like you must be an idiot. No, these people are fucking everywhere in this industry. And we need to change the industry, because at the moment it serves the sharks to just keep getting away with it. Do you know what I mean? It's too easy to rip artists off. And I think in an environment that's like at nighttime, where you're traveling constantly, you're working illegal hours, you might be traveling in conditions that aren't even necessarily safe, like cramming into a vat, depending on your budget, driving through the night, staying in cheap hotels. And what you're supposed to be like completely responsible whilst playing shows every night for like keeping on top of your accountant, keeping on top of your manager, everyone in your, like your tour manager, your manager, they might have like business cards in your name. Like the amount of cleanup that it requires, honestly, is like you need like a robot assistant that is an imprint of you that you trust, because it's just a robot AI version of yourself.
Interesting thing I'll come back to, Kate, is that you know one of the things that's very distinctive about you as an individual with your music is you literally and metaphorically sing in your own voice. But it's interesting when you said that you have to do emails, it's like, oh, I have to write this in a more professional way. It's like maybe the answer is to do it in your own voice.
This is Gem Archer, and you're listening to the Stage Left podcast.
Look, trust red flags, right? Like when there's a red flag, there's a red flag for a reason. Also, I just thought of a practical thing that I think is really helpful. Check your bank statements, approve budgets, go through budgets. Like learn about money in a way that, like, and I do think there should be more education for like musicians to like be educated about how to spend money, how to live, like work out sort of whatever your lifestyle is that you're living, like how much does it cost to like live where you live, eat food monthly, and then how much does it cost to like make the music that you're making? Have you agreed before you go into a room with a producer what the splits are, how they're being paid? Be comfortable talking about money. The only annoying thing is when I was like completely independent, a lot of people aren't comfortable talking to artists directly about money and business. So even when you're like trying to do that for yourself, a lot of people like don't know how to do it with artists. They want the buffer of a manager because it's like difficult for them. But like check your bank statements. And if people have like cards in your name, check those statements, like go through. It's boring, but like check the, you know, the charges that are being made, because I've had experiences where I've gone on tour and I haven't done that. And then like there's more charges than were agreed upon on the card. And you've gone like thousands of dollars over the budget, thousands of pounds over the budget. And it's too late because it's like the end of the tour and you trusted that person. And that's not my tour manager that I work with now. But, you know, things like this can happen really easily to like artists. And you'd think, oh, how does that happen? Well, it's because there's like business cards in your name and you're traveling on a tour bus and all this stuff is being like booked and you're doing shows every single night. So maybe you're not on top of it. It's really difficult, you know. If someone's pressuring you to sign a contract, if that's like a real urgent thing, I think that like, unless there's a logistical reason that it's urgent that you sign the contract, like there's some kind of deadline that makes sense. You know, this, we want to do this. So if you want to do it by then, we need to sign the contract. But if someone is just pressuring you just because it's the, and if that, that's the red flag to me, if someone's like, I really, really need you to sign a management contract. I'm like, why? I don't know. I just don't, in my experience, those people haven't really had the best intentions. So anything that feels like someone's rushing you or pressuring you for something without like a logical reason, I wouldn't trust it.
It's really interesting because I don't work in the music industry. So I do this podcast, but I work in the charity sector and in the education sector. And it's always really interesting, but I have a lot of friends who are really in the industry. And it always strikes me when I listen to these types of situations, it's like the music industry is like, just needs a massive HR department.
Yeah, no, mate, it needs a massive HR department. Yeah,
it's the Wild
my
West.
Friends,
it's,
one of my
everyone
friends
else would be sacked for all this stuff. You know, if you did exactly. Stuff like this, you'd just be sacked. Like, you know,
yeah, you can't believe some of the stuff. Like one of my friends was saying recently, I wish we would stop calling it the music industry. I'm not going to call it that anymore. It's a pyramid scheme. Like this is not an industry. Like it shouldn't be labeled as that anymore. But you're right. There's no HR. So who do you go to when the people that you trust the most have other ones that have screwed you over? Like, who do you go to? Like, I got dropped by my record label, couldn't go to them anymore, and stolen from by a manager. So, like, who am I going to in times of trouble? I mean, my band, myself, my, like you can sort of, like, stumble through it in a way and end up finding good people still. And I hope this isn't, like, putting people off as well, because I think, like, we need like more people to come in with more information. And I hope that younger generations also like have better standards or something. Cause like I think that like they'll be less tolerant of some of the stuff that we've maybe had to put up with. I don't know.
This conversation is definitely not designed to put people off. It's designed to safeguard people basically
yeah.
from the very situations that you experience. So there's two parts, if you like, of the musical success brain, which is critical acclaim versus mm-hmm. record sales, right, or commercial success. And every artist walks that tightrope and has a very, very interesting relationship between those two places. Where are you at now with those two places, and how do you navigate that tightrope between critical acclaim and commercial success? Because it's very rare to get both of them.
Yeah, I think for me, I have reached a point where I'm sort of not really worried about either. I think that like I don't know, like I've created a career that is like not conventional, and I feel like I exist outside of both those things, and I have like an amazing fan base who just accept me for who I am. And I feel like now it's really about just getting records out and like writing music that I love and believing that I think is really good, because I don't think you can really like, I don't know, like you can't guarantee either of those things, like critical acclaim or commercial success. Like you can sometimes pay for them, but if you're independent, it's like I think focusing on just making music that you're proud of and that you think is really good is the most important thing to me. So things that I believe that that's where I'm at. I'm just also like the gratefulness to be doing it after the pandemic and Yeah.
What do you think has allowed you to get to that mindset? Like, are there certain things in place that allow you to be able to have that? I kind of don't care about it now.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, experience, age. I've been doing this so long and I've managed to, like, survive some of the worst parts of it. Touch wood, hopefully it doesn't get worse than that. But, like, once you've kind of lost everything and you think, oh, I'm never going to be able to do this again, and then you do it again and you keep doing it again. And then there's a global pandemic and everyone's thinking, are we ever going to be able to do this again? And then you do it again. I think it's like, I also look at the way the world is now, the industry. I can't figure it out, man. I don't know, like, what is, I'm not going to sit there and try and, like, work out how to be big on TikTok. Like, you know, I've tried TikTok. I started using TikTok when the Brit Awards were associated with TikTok, where it was like vote for, and I was like, oh, so this is like a legitimate music industry thing. I was like, I guess I should, like, be on it. And I went on it and I had, like, a little bit of a viral moment on there. And I was like, I guess this is cool in a way, but really it's so, like, time consuming. And then there's also parts of it that I think are very, like, uncool and just sort of, I don't know, I'm not trying to be in the zeitgeist anymore. Like, I'm just past that age. Do you know what I mean? I just don't need that. And I don't feel like I need, like, massive commercial success. I think that I'm in a really lucky, unique position. And I just really want to feed my fan base and then I love making music. I love recording songs. That's, like, so fun for me. And then I just find ways of putting that music out. And it's frustratingly sometimes, like, slower than I would like it to be. But every time you put music out, it's different. And I think that if you let go of, like, wanting those things, then it doesn't really, I don't know. It's more, I honestly, I only think, like, age and experience can get you there. I think you're going to want those things until you get to a point where you're more comfortable with yourself.
And this question might be too personal, we can edit out, but what about if you're broke? So what if someone is broke, like, navigating that tightrope? So think back to the time where you didn't have any money because you were ripped off, and let's say Glow hadn't come about.
Yeah.
Where does that tightrope then sit, and how do you navigate your integrity versus keeping a roof over your head?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely went through a phase of trying to, like, do, but again, though, it's like, it's not a guarantee. It's not a job that's like, you're going to do these, this and this, and you will get this. That is, it's just no guarantee. You can try all those things. You can try and make the most commercial music ever, and it can go nowhere. Like, there is, like, a song graveyard bigger than the one outside of New York. Like, there are so many songs that, like, you've never heard that people are just, like, constantly making, and they're like sausage factory pop hell, and they never come out, or, like, the singer that's on it, like, it never gets released. It's like, there's really no way of guaranteeing the commercial world. So I think, you do everything, if you're broke, you do everything you can. You might have to move back in with your parents. You might have to move to a cheaper area. You might have to sell some of your guitars if you have them. You might have to work in a cafe for a bit or a comic book store for a while. You find, like, producers that will work for you for free, and then you can pay them later, or you can split a percentage with them. You try to book shows. It's just so unique also to your career. Like, what does your career look like? What does your fan base look like? What does your touring look like? It's really hard to say, because I don't think there's any guarantees in this business, unfortunately.
Interesting thing you said amongst that is about, you know, as long as it's, you know, you're measuring your happiness around this, around whether it's successful, right? And successful, that is such a, like, subjective term. Like, so Bob Dylan once said, like, success is basically getting up in the morning, then going to bed at night, and in that time between, just doing what you want, right? But then for other people, it's like commercial success, critical success. So what is the metrics of success for you?
You know, success is doing this for a living. That's success. And being able to, like, connect. I think when you play live, that's really, for me, that's when I feel what I'm doing is getting through. Like, when I put stuff out, it's so difficult to know, like, to have any emotional connection to like numbers or, you know. But when you play a gig and you like see people like singing your music, that's like the best feeling ever. And being able to keep doing that is the most important thing to me.
So let's talk about performance. Who do you become on stage when you're performing at a gig that you aren't so much off stage?
I feel like I'm not self-conscious in the way that I am when I'm off stage. And even if I'm feeling self-conscious 5 minutes before going on, there's something about performing that's really freeing. And I don't know what it is. It's like, it's, you embody this sort of like confidence and you're communicating like music and lyrics to an audience who's like receptive to it. And there's this like invisible thread between you guys that like you sort of know each other, but you don't, you know, like my fans, my music might be with my fans through heartbreak or, you know, just important moments in their life, whether that's like graduation or a funeral, like a wedding. It's like, I, you know, you're at like people's moments in their life. So they kind of know that, and they attach their lives to your lyrics. So then they really know you. And with the internet now, you can kind of know them a little bit. And so you have this like strange connection where you're not really friends, but you're like connected through the music. And for some reason that just, I just feel so confident on stage in a way that I feel like I don't in real life. Like, for example, if I'm going to a meeting, I don't know how to dress. I'll be like, oh, what do I wear? Like, how do I dress as a normal person at a meeting? You know, because I feel like my job was almost like being a clown. I get to like dress up and be this like performer. And I have so much confidence on stage in how to talk to an audience, how to talk and just how to connect and make them feel really good. And like I said, I don't know how to like write an email or like dress for a meeting, but like throw me on stage and I'll feel so confident.
So interesting answer. Like, yeah, it's imposter syndrome, right? It's just like trying to, you know, in that situation with meetings and stuff like that, I'll just say, just be yourself, because that's working on stage, right?
So yeah.
It's probably easier said than done.
Maybe I need to bring a little stage around with me and then just stand on it and then I'll feel good. Like
treat everywhere as a stage, basically. That's the answer. Is the music industry fair? And if you became president of the music industry for a week, what laws would you create?
Agree, definitely not fair. I'm like thinking of all the things I would do as president. I would set the law that all of the heads of every label that exists, major label and big indie labels, all of the heads of those labels had to resign. And I just think that like so many of them are not, we need new people in these positions. I would like the heads of agencies, major agencies, booking agencies had to resign, and the heads of like festivals had to resign, and that there is like a really in-depth process of like who is given those positions in the workplace and why, so that we start to like book artists more fairly. We start to like think about artists in a like fairer way. I think that anyone who wants to work in the music industry has to spend at least 6 months touring in a van on a budget on the East Coast of America during the winter. That's like, you can't be working in the music industry unless you've done that tour. I would say that per stream we are paid, I mean, I want to say like we're paid £1 per stream, but even if we were paid like 20p per stream, we would be doing so well. So fair pay per stream of our music. And those are like the three things that I would start with. And I think like some kind of board, an ethical board and a huge HR department that like is like built like a CAA building, or a universal building, but it's just an HR building. And like every single record label and agency and and booker and lawyer and publisher has to go through a huge HR department process where loads of people are going to get fired, and everyone's going to have to go through training and pass courses and like learn how to treat people ethically in business. Yeah, and those are like my four main. I'm president. We're going to be paid a pound per stream. I mean, I'm president, right? I should just go for the pound. But 20p, if I have to, you know, bargain with someone about that, I'm moving up for 20p.
Nice.
That stream.
So after the release of Coffee Wars, which is out at the moment, what's next for you, Kate?
I have a show at Omira in London. It's the 10-year anniversary show of my record Girl Talk, which I'm really excited about. I'm playing live at Leeds. I'm playing a bunch of festivals this summer, Truck Festival, Why Not Festival, Tramlines, Victorious. I think that's it, but like a bunch of festivals that I'm really excited about playing and just getting back out there. Festival season, it's been a while, so I'm really excited to do that.
Awesome. And I guess another thing I would just quickly add, I want to delve into one song of yours, which I heard today, which was incredible, which is called Don't You Want to Share the Guilt?
Oh, cool.
And the second half of that is an absolute work of art. And I just wondered what your memories are of, you know, I can't imagine you'd have done that much stuff with such a special orchestral part before that. So that must have been... wow, I've not hit the big time, but that must have been such an incredible... What do you remember about writing that song and then hearing the orchestral parts being put on? That must have been incredible.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I wrote that in the studio on acoustic guitar, I think. So it was like this really low-key thing. I feel like I'd been writing bits of it on my phone or in a notebook, like a monologue, because it turns into that sort of ranting monologue. So I was writing a little bit of like spoken word at that time and sort of wanting to mesh that into my music a bit, and finding a way to sort of like express my anxiety, I guess. And yeah, I still have these feelings when there's an orchestra in a studio. I think it's so exciting and you feel so honored to have these very talented, professional classical musicians taking something that might have just been a melody in your head and turning it into this like massive production and this really hi-fi production. It's still one of my favorite things to work with an orchestra. And yeah, when you're kind of standing behind the glass in the studio and like seeing them all in there, it's really feels like this big thing that's happening that you made like you get to make something happen just from a melody into this like work of art almost. It like takes little ideas in your head and put and you kind of see how big things can get. It's a really good example of like why, you know, keeping some of these melodies or these ideas around, actually like you can really transform them into something big and beautiful, which is really fun.
And that's what it is. So you and I are of a similar age. I'm a bit older and I never made it in the music industry just by trying, and you did. And one thing I remember that was very distinctive about you when you came about is you really sing in your own voice. And I remember, so I'm from London or Greater London. And I remember the word I can't, or the phrase I can't, which you use a lot. I found myself saying I can't. And people would say it's an Americanism, but it wasn't.
Right.
It was a Northernism.
And
it's really interesting. When you came about, you totally owned the can't thing, because I, and there's obviously lots of other words that applies to. And I wonder if, because I remember thinking, if I said I can't in a song, I can't believe it, or whatever it might be, listeners would think, oh, this is someone who just sits around with having tea with Prince William and like a future king or whatever. Like there's this judgment of being, oh, I can't. Oh, I can't do something. And so I used to sing in this kind of, this northern, well, I'd say I can't. Did you ever think about that?
Right. I never thought of that, because
really?
I can't. Yeah, because like can't is still, it doesn't, it's not necessarily posh, is it? Can't. I can't. It's just always a decision. I think in the studio sometimes when I'm singing things that have like a T or an, I think I used to think about it less when I was younger, because I think you do when you're young, you're just kind of, I definitely knew I wanted to sing in my own voice, but my voice has like changed over the years, you know. But I went to school, I'm from North Harrow, I went to school in South London, And it's kind of, you know, I lived in LA for 9 years, but obviously don't have an American accent. But I've always kept my London accent and how I speak in my music. But I think sometimes I do make decisions. Like, if you're repeating something, I think you think of it more. Like in my song Waste Man, I say, I'm on my own shit. And if I was talking to you, I'd be like, I'm on my own shit. I wouldn't be like, I'm on my own shit. But sometimes when I was singing it, I was like, oh, I missed the T there because of just how it sounds. And like, I want it to be more rounded. And it was a bit lost. It was like, I'm on my own shit. It just like, it was kind of annoying me hearing it over and over again. Even though I am a bit lazy when I speak, I don't always add T's to the end of my sentences. But I changed it in the studio because I was like, and then I sort of made most of them have the T, and every now and then it was softer. It was like it needed a mix because it was so repetitive in the song that I didn't want it to kind of get annoying. So yeah, I think about it a bit more now with things like that. But when I was younger, I never really thought about it.
It's because I interviewed a guy called Chaz Hodges, who was in Chaz and Dave. I don't know if you remember. And he said their success is simply the fact that they were just authentic to themselves and they didn't try and sound like anything else. They were from London and they sang in a London way.
That's like Johnny Cash does that too. You know, there's that thing where they were like, oh, why do you play slower than, they said, why do you play slower than everyone else? And they're like that's like, it was a new style. And they're like, oh, we're just playing like as fast as we can.
Yeah, got it.
So it kind of created a new sound, which I think is quite cool.
Well, thanks so much to you, Kate, for willing to share so much around some of the challenges you face in the music industry. Clearly from our conversation, things need to change and you've mapped out a perfect way in which we could possibly get there in future. Best of luck with the upcoming shows. Best of luck with the festivals in the summer. Great to see that you're back out touring again. And best of luck also, of course, to the new film, which is available to view right now called Coffee Wars. I'd really recommend it. It's a great watch. Thanks very much for joining us on the Stage Left podcast.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much for having us. It's been really fun.
For more episodes featuring comedian Stuart Lee, Tony Visconti, Gem Archer of Oasis, David Bowie bassist Gail Ann Dorsey, Queen's musical director Spike Edney, the police manager Miles Copeland III, Kate Nash, Ian Brody, Stormzy producer Fraser T. Smith, Katie Cole of the Smashing Pumpkins, Clive Deamer of Radiohead, and Richard Fortus of Guns N' Roses, go to thestagelefpodcast.com and drop us a DM on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter to let us know what your biggest takeaway was from each interview. Search The Stage Left Pod and you'll find us.